the title, Surveillance After Snowden. So yes, I am saying something about surveillance. And I understand surveillance to be an antique set of practices that certainly predates the digital. It has developed over many centuries, and I actually started out in history and have a strong interest in the historical dimensions of surveillance as they have developed over the years. Surveillance has to do with the relations between power and knowledge. Overtones of Foucault right there, and can be summarized, in my view, as systematic and focused attention to personal details for the purposes of influence, entitlement, management, and other similar purposes. So I regard it as systematic, usually routine, focused attention to personal details. And it has to be for specific purposes, because I'm talking about a gaze rather than a glance. So that's the definition, broad definition, with which I am beginning. As you can hear from that definition, it is deeply ambiguous. It is not something that is on its own sinister or malign. It is neither good nor bad, and it is never, ever neutral. I'm also saying a little bit about Edward Snowden. As you know, the US citizen who achieved fame and notoriety, depending on how you look at it, last year and ever since, including today. I haven't managed to listen to him today, but I'll get to it. You can tell me what he said if it is something we should consider. He took illegally certain classified documents about government surveillance from the company where he was working, which was contracted to the NSA. Do I think he is an heroic whistleblower or a misguided traitor? Your call. You can decide what you think I think about that question. In some ways, as you will hear, the question is something of a distraction from the reality of the situation that he's uncovered, and it is that situation that I would sooner draw your attention to than making some tabloid binary decision about where he stands. Snowden says we should have listened to Orwell's warning. He has told us that more than once since June 2013. I say we should listen to Snowden's warning, because the disclosures that he has been making are about far more than something like privacy. I also want to say something about the snooping scandal, so-called, that has resulted. In many minds, Snowden has revealed state surveillance out of control. And I'm going to try to decode this somewhat, but not in a technical way, simply in the way of trying to contextualize and giving some wider frames for us to consider. In a sense, I think we are looking at surveillance out of control. And I do think that citizens of the US and Canada and other countries should be concerned about what it is that he is revealing. Part of the problem, however, is that the situation has already been obfuscated by the use of certain kinds of words. And there are specific words like metadata, which are frequently and, it seems to me, sometimes willfully misused, as if somehow metadata was never something that could give you identifiable information about persons. And just a word back to the definition. I'm thinking primarily about human surveillance, if you like. I said personal details, by which I'm meaning human persons. That, of course, may be surveillance that relates to objects which log our activities. So The surveillance may be of objects, but I'm thinking of what it can reveal about the objects that are connected with those devices. Beyond such questions about metadata, however, I think there are larger questions that we could address coming out of the Snowden revelations. I think that what we are seeing could be framed as a transformation in governance, or as signs of a possible transformation in governance. And I'd like us to think about that and discuss that together. And by that, I'm referring to something that has, yes, to do with citizens and states, but also to do with relations between states. Both things are tremendously important in the Snowden revelations. Snowden's disclosures challenge us to look more deeply, I think, at what is going on, and to recognize that surveillance, as it has been revealed over the past few months, has a long history, as I say, and a context, and its meaning, I think, is changing yet again. Our responses to it may well be in terms of binaries, or we may clutch at words like privacy, but I want to suggest to you that some of the kinds of responses that we make to surveillance grow from the very same soil as the kinds of surveillance that we are seeing today. And therefore, too, I want to suggest there are wider frames. So some of what I have to say will speak to the big picture. We're in this now. I want to suggest that, yes, there are some new ways of approaching these issues. I have worked with a number of excellent colleagues in Canada and around the world for many years now on the subject of surveillance. And it's from that teamwork that I offer some insights. I'm very loath to... I heard the introduction, and it's very gracious to mention all these things, but it really is teamwork that we do together, and I represent a team. Not that they necessarily agree with everything I say, but I do work with a team. We just finished a collaborative project called Transparent Lives. And the subtitle is Surveillance in Canada, but frankly, precisely the same 9 trends in surveillance also apply in the US. It comes out in May this year. Being Canada, it comes out simultaneously in French and English, but it also comes out as a free PDF online, so you might be interested to take a look. As I say, every one of our 9 key trends applies very strongly in the US as it does in Canada. It's just that you'll find that most of the illustrations in this book are taken from Canada. And we're just on the cusp of a new project that looks at big data surveillance and examines some of the particular ways in which those trends are now being expressed in the hyped language of big data. Hyped, but all too real in some context. Attending to the big picture, then, also means remembering that these issues are in no ways trivial. They affect what we believe about the world in which we live and our place in it. How do we want to relate to each other? And how is this affected by our new media-saturated environment? I know there's more than one of you here who's interested in that broader dimension of the question. And I want to indicate how such questions may not be answered in any kind of rationalistic manner, and to create space for open dialogue with people from different disciplines, for sure, but also different philosophical and religious perspectives about the common good. Are privacy and autonomy really the nub of the matter, as liberal political and legal theory might suggest? Or are questions of trust, truth, freedom, dignity, human flourishing closer to the mark? So, what was leaked? Well, I suspect that some of you have noted some of the things that have been leaked. I'll try to give you some clues about what seemed to me to be significant issues here. Telephone and internet data certainly has been leaked, and information about how it's been surveilled has been leaked. And that's, again, definitely concerns millions of Americans, among others, from some of the biggest telecommunications corporations, such as Verizon. Soon after those initial revelations in June last year, we heard about PRISM, which is the name for a clandestine data collection and data mining program that is directly connected with the servers of Google, Apple, Yahoo, Microsoft, and others, which circumvented encryption and privacy controls. Through that, members of the public discovered that in some ways they had been betrayed when they believed what was said about the security of their data with those corporations. It would not go further, they were assured, and that, it seems, was not the case. We also have noted over the past months the global scope of what has happened. The NSA is the National Security Agency is the main organization that is in view here. And one of its systems is called Boundless Informant. And you can see one of their maps on the current slide. Boundless Informant records and maps where intelligence metadata come from. And it was very interesting when Boundless Informant was shown to us, because the NSA had frequently said that because of the complexity and scope of their activities, that it was impossible to keep a clear record of what was going on. But here it became perfectly evident that there was a real-time, very complex audit being kept of all their activities. They could indeed keep track of what they were doing at the NSA. These metadata, in this case and in the domestic ones, include the IP address that gives away the country, the state or province and city that the computer is in, and easily reveals other information as well. Last year, some Stanford researchers, without a research grant, just working on their own, managed in only a few hours to identify the users, Android phone users of Yelp, Google, Places, and so on, with a 91 out of 100 percent accuracy. So even without the help of large funding, they could make those identifications from these metadata. Some of these things I'm going to skip over. They'll be on the overhead, but I'm going to skip them. Certainly the NSA secures what they call diplomatic advantage by spying on governments of other countries and citizens of other countries, including its close allies. Again, you'll be aware of the outcry following the discovery of cell phone monitoring of Angela Merkel in Germany and Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, president and chancellor, respectively. And others, too, have discovered that their own phones have been checked within this surveillance scheme. Also, that other governments, such as that of Israel, other corporations, such as Thales, such as Total, and NGOs, such as Médecins Sans Frontières, was also revealed. So there are numerous ways in which the NSA has been shown to be working at a number of different levels, internationally, and in a variety of organizations. Also true of Canada, there are a number of things that have excited the attention of our own population and our own media in Canada. One example maybe I'll share with you is that it was revealed in November last year that during the G8, G10 summit in Toronto in 2010, which was notorious for other reasons, the Canadian government allowed the NSA to set up business inside the American embassy in Ottawa and to do what it is illegal for our equivalent of the NSA to do on Canadian citizens. So it's illegal for our equivalent, CSEC, the Communications Security Establishment of Canada, to surveil Canadian citizens. And the Canadian government arranged for the NSA to actually set up in the embassy to do that work for them. This is a case, as with several of the revelations that Snowden has disclosed, in which illegal activity was going on. I should also say that I'm not a lawyer and I can't say that definitely, but leading legal opinion in Canada argues that that whole set of activities with the NSA working in the American Embassy in Ottawa was in fact illegal. There was also another one in Canada. I'll give you one more in Canada. This was interesting too. Over a number of weeks in February this year, it was revealed in February this year that over a number of weeks in Canada, I think it was probably at Pearson Airport in Toronto, we weren't given the details, the airport Wi-Fi system was used by the NSA to track people going through the airport in such a way that their movements before and after entering the airport would also be available. So, many things might be said about this. Certainly, they raise questions for debate, as I was suggesting at the beginning. And in some ways, it has unleashed a debate. It's often couched about being a debate over the balance between civil liberties and national security, about the scope and protocols of U.S. Government surveillance, about the relationship between the NSA and internet and telephone companies, about web infrastructure and national sovereignty, about the meaning of privacy in a world where Big Brother could be listening. But as I say, while the debate has in some ways circulated around those ideas, I also think that there are questions about social trust and suspicion that we should address, and questions about how far democratic political activity is still available to us in ways that we once imagined it was. So how do digital data make a difference? I'm going to refer you to some of these points. First, qualifying the digital difference. Let me say again that surveillance is not a separate and distinct activity in our world today relating to espionage or to intelligence gathering. In the sense that I defined it, it has become a key means of organization. It is a way that any organization operates. MIT will have an extensive surveillance capacity in all kinds of areas. Sometimes, in some university settings, they're relatively integrated. In others, they're dispersed and not necessarily joined together. So everything from the registry department in a university to residence life to alumni associations to advancement to media and communication to campus security to you name it, there are numerous departments of any university that utilize what I'm thinking of as surveillance methods in order to do their daily work. So I want to argue that it's not something that is somehow special and different. Obviously, espionage and government intelligence gathering is a particular kind of surveillance, but I just want to stress that what I'm talking about is something that is widespread. So that systematic, routine, focused attention to personal details with a view to management, control, influence, and so on is there in every organization in the present day. Secondly, the story sort of going back through to the beginning of digital times, as it were, is inadequate. We also need to look at longer stories of where surveillance has come from, and longer stories within modernity, longer technological stories of surveillance. Changes in surveillance and its technologies began to be particularly rapid from the mid-19th century on. Very often we think about the mid-20th century on. I would like to argue for the mid-19th century. Evidence-producing technologies that led to a ramping up of surveillance capacities included the camera, the telephone, the typewriter, the phonograph, the telegraph. All of these and others were what some historians call evidence-producing machines, and they were very important precursors of contemporary forms of technologically augmented surveillance. These changes, too, have never existed on their own. Technology does not ever move according to its own logic. The silicon chip was already a child of the Cold War and must be understood within that military-industrial context. The political economy of surveillance reveals all kinds of interesting details in its history. Commercial forms of surveillance. I have colleagues in the business school at Queen's, and they are in marketing. Now, what they call marketing, I call surveillance. And we have some very good discussions about what each of us means in these contexts. But I should say, they fully understand that what I am describing as surveillance is exactly what they do. So it's not as if we don't know what each is talking about. But again, to imagine that it's, you know, late 20th century business schools that invented the idea of marketing, enhanced by new technologies, is also a mistake. American department stores were keeping close tabs on individual consumers and classifying them according to their spending power, their preferences, and so on and so forth from the early 20th century onwards. They didn't wait for computers to be invented later in the century. Another important thing is there is a what I call a future tense shift. One way that digital data do help to make a difference or facilitate a difference is in shifting surveillance more and more into the future tense. Most obvious illustration of that, popular illustration, the film Minority Report, which in 2002, almost coinciding with 9/11, uncannily almost coinciding with 9/11, showed how far surveillance was going in attempting to anticipate, prevent, preempt certain kinds of activities before they occur. Other TV shows like Person of Interest also have the same kind of rationale to them. The Department of Homeland Security has an aim of connecting the dots, but it's increasingly one that requires data to be collected and held onto for as long as possible before there is any hint of suspicion about any particular thing within those data. The CIA's chief technology officer, Gus Hunt, says this, neat connection with what I was just saying. Quote, since you can't connect the dots you don't have, we try to collect everything and hang on to it forever. Candid statement. And this, of course, raises all kinds of questions for already existing legal limits on various kinds of surveillance. The kinds of things that we are already familiar with. The idea that users should consent to having their data collected for particular purposes. It throws such things completely out of the window. It doesn't even come into the question, the idea of consent. And so generations of what are called fair information principles are completely thrown in question by these kinds of trends. And of course, by creating suspects, we undermine things like a presumption of innocence. Crucially important, I think, to Western legal systems is the idea of the presumption of innocence. But if you are included within a suspect group, then that is already being undermined. We have to go back to the Risk Society to think about some of the contexts of this. I'm going to slide over that, and also the fact that digital surveillance is much cheaper than other forms and therefore is very attractive to those who are trying to save money at any level, municipally, and by state, or nationally. But it's important to remember that there are some simple economics going on here that make some of these kinds of techniques highly attractive. Let me just say a bit about digital dreams. North America in particular seems singularly prone to what I call digital dreams, to believing that more technology is better and that technology will provide the answer to most human problems. And as you know, many tech corporations describe their products as solutions, so much so that, as you are also aware, they tend to shape the problems which they supposedly solve. One of my colleagues at Queen's, Vincent Moscow, dubs this belief in the power of technology as the digital sublime. Following David Nye's work, he talks about the digital sublime, the ways in which a myth of techno power becomes dominant and supports the political economic growth of those new technologies, even when challenged by major events such as 9/11. Well, we can discuss that some more. Such mythologies, if mythologies they are especially significant in relation to the development of what I'm calling big data surveillance. And then what I'd refer to as smudged sector surveillance. Public and private agencies doing surveillance increasingly merge and meld into one. Snowden himself, of course, was working for a contracted out aspect of the NSA's work. It was often from last century onwards in commercial sectors that new surveillance regimes were developed in the first place, before they were developed in other, particularly government areas. Database marketing was far ahead in that commercial sphere than in policing in the United States by the 1980s. And that trend has intensified of smudging the difference between different kinds of agencies. From the point of view of us ordinary citizens and consumers, smudging the difference between what we once innocently thought of as different silos of data. The stores have these kinds of data on us. The government departments have these. That kind of distinction that I think a lot of us still hold just as a sort of background mental idea becomes increasingly hard to sustain when you look at the evidence of what is actually happening, and the Snowden revelations have helped us a lot to see the connections between commercial kinds of surveillance and others. And of course, after 9/11, if you look at where the DHS went for help in considering how to locate terrorist cells or terrorist activity, they did not go to the FBI, the CIA, NSA. They went to CRM. You know what CRM is? Customer Relationship Management. That's where they went. And that is where they forged some very interesting links between those who were doing marketing and now those who were doing intelligence work. Well, I guess for some of you this sounds Orwellian. And that is what, as I say, Snowden was warning us about. It certainly sounds as if things have moved faster than we had imagined or anticipated, and without very much public knowledge, which is where Snowden comes in. But things also seem to go on as they did before. For many people, it just seems to be business as usual, and the Snowden revelations are a sort of little sideshow on the edge of life. There was clearly outcry in Germany, clearly outcry in Brazil, and in several other countries, and within several organizations about what was discovered through, or what has been discovered, is being discovered through Snowden. But there's only muted protest. How many of you here in this room even noted that February the 11th was the day we fight back? Okay, so a minority, but there are some of you noticed. But there were many people who did not even notice that day, which was in some ways an amazing collection of actors working around the world simultaneously to try to raise questions directly from the Snowden revelations. So, what kinds of effects does government surveillance have? As I already hinted, it creates suspects on a mass scale. And this is one of the things that Snowden says that he hoped to demonstrate through his disclosures. The decision by Judge Leon here in the US last December was this, or quote from it is this: "I cannot imagine a more indiscriminate and arbitrary invasion than this systematic and high-tech collection and retention of personal data on virtually every single citizen for the purposes of querying and analyzing it without prior judicial approval." He added, "Surely such a program infringes on that degree of privacy that the founders enshrined in the Fourth Amendment." Well, you heard what Leon said, you heard what was said after him by other legal opinion too. But there is a clear question there about suspects on a mass scale. But what about cumulative disadvantage? Cumulative disadvantage, I would argue, is something that has become increasingly important within various surveillance regimes. Especially in the 21st century, but I think it was coming to be clear in the 1990s onward too. And but what I'm meaning by this is that contemporary forms of surveillance, in the way that I've defined it and tried to describe it a little bit, works primarily by dividing populations into groups, classifying them according to certain kinds of characteristics in order that those groups can be treated differently and so that they can obtain the benefits that they need, or police can check up on that particular group, or whatever. So that's the way that surveillance works increasingly, and of course that is very much enabled and facilitated by the development of digital technologies. It occurs across the board. In the case of the post-9/11 kinds of activities, clearly the categories described as Arab and Muslim became usual suspects. Everybody knows that, and everybody knows that life became much more difficult for those who were thus classified, both in the United States and Canada and many other countries around the world. It became a fact of life. It became something that you had to deal with if you were from a background that was construed as Arab or Muslim. And if you talk to any of your friends who are in that category, you will find out pretty quickly just what it was like and is like to cross borders. But the stereotypical activity goes beyond this. So, for example, there are studies that show that journalists who are trying to cover some terrorist question will frequently go to Islamic experts to find out more, even if there is not a shred of evidence that some Arab or Muslim had anything to do with the question under consideration. And so the stereotypical activity continues throughout, in this case, the media So there are other aspects to this. There are also notorious examples of major issues that have been caused by what have been described as mistakes. Our own Canadian citizen, Meher Arar, is a very good case in point. He was subject to extraordinary rendition in 2003 and taken from JFK on his way back to Canada from visiting his parents-in-law in Tunisia. And he's an engineer in Ottawa. And he was taken to Syria and he was tortured for 1 year. And on his eventual release and return, it was determined that he was entirely innocent, that there was no connection whatsoever. And the Canadian government, after it had been through the courts, determined that he should be compensated. So he was compensated for $10 million as a result of this horrendous miscarriage of justice. I have to say, however, that he is still very unwelcome in this country. He has never been exonerated. His name has never been cleared. He's still regarded as a dangerous person. If you were to meet him, you would pretty soon learn what kind of a person he is. I've met him, and he is he's someone who suffered a lot. And it was through precisely the kind of cumulative disadvantage that was meted out to Arab Muslim persons. Chilling effects, too, are tremendously important effects of such increased surveillance. Do you remember the Penn report that came from the writers in December last year? Here we see chilling effects very clearly. That's the title also of their report. 88% of writers who were polled by Penn are troubled by what's happening in the NSA. 24% avoid certain topics in emails and phone calls. 16% abandon a project because of its sensitivity, and so on. These are leading writers. You may remember that 562 writers around the world signed a petition, Writers Against Mass Surveillance, as their response to the Snowden revelations. After all that, then, why do we tolerate this? Let me suggest three reasons. We tolerate it. Well, we do seem to tolerate it, for a start. There is lots of complacency around, even though some opinion polls have shown some interesting results in terms of the numbers of people who approve of Snowden's activities, for example. More of us in Canada do than in the States, by the way. 67% approve Snowden's actions in Canada, to the UK's 60% and the US 51%. Neat polarization in the US. Anyway, interesting too to see in this connection how many people claim to trust their governments with their personal data. Who would have guessed? 7% in the UK, 5% in Canada and the US. Interesting. Anyway, but there's a difference between talking with pollsters about opinion and broader trends that might help us understand this. I think one clear reason for relative complacency is the sheer familiarity that we have with the everyday surveillance that goes on round about us, whether it has to do with cameras in public places, whether it has to do with the fact that we're aware from all those banner ads on our social media sites and the internet sites that we visit, whatever. We know that surveillance is going on, we've become familiar with it. In many ways, it's normalized and domesticated. I sometimes ask students, why do they continue to carry PTDs with them from day to day? They carry their PTDs everywhere, and I suspect that most people here carry a PTD as well. They are marketed as smartphones, but PTD stands for personal tracking device. And it's a good question. I mean, sure, they operate as smartphones as well. You have features on them that give some benefit to the user. But PTDs is pretty much what they are, as far as I can make out. We don't notice them. We think of them just as smartphones. Fear is a second, especially after 9/11. And of course, government, security companies, and the media have played very much on the fear factor, and lots has been researched and written about this. It's a winner for corporations trying to sell new equipment, for governments that see their task as allowing market forces free reign and their key role as maintaining security, and for the media that depends on polarizing good versus bad, without distinguishing between those who really are terrorists and others who might be, for example, legal protesters against environmental degradation, human rights abuses, Aboriginal exploitation, undocumented migrants, or whatever. So ramping up fear has also, I think, led to a certain complacency. And then there's fun, seen especially in social media. Implications of surveillance after 9/11 and the growth of social media coincided, and it turns out were mutually supportive. User-generated content is what we think of as the rationale of social media. So information isn't just provided by large organizations out there. Information is provided by everyone. We participate in this. Social media operates not only through user input, but crucially through relationships between different users. And that's tremendously important to remember. Facebook's friends are the most obvious and simple example to follow. They're also, in many ways, the most pervasive. And people engage with Facebook and other social media using their real identities and connecting with others of similar outlook to them. So if you recall what I said about the way that surveillance works, it works very strongly in categorizing according to certain criteria and treating different groups differently. So this was Zuckerberg's gift to surveillance, to enable ordinary users to classify themselves to reduce the labor power required by the organizations. We do it. We classify ourselves by admitting to our preferences, our beliefs, which team we support, which band we like, and so on and so forth. We put all the information in, and it makes it so much easier to do what they do. All these three, and probably others too, help to produce what I'm thinking of as compliance, not critique. So what's really at stake here? Well, there's a digital dragnet which I think in some ways denies democratic activity. I suggested that there maybe is an underlying transformation in state and citizen relationships that we see through the Snowden revelations. Snowden himself says it's a far cry. I'm quoting, it's a far cry between legal programs, legitimate spying, legitimate law enforcement, where it is targeted based on reasonable suspicion, individualized suspicion, and warranted action, and the sort of dragnet surveillance that puts entire populations under a sort of eye and sees everything, even when it's not needed. Obviously, I'm quoting from an interview there, and so it's in the vernacular, but he's making a very good point, it seems to me. Snowden, again, says this, talking now about Petrobras in Brazil and the monitoring of Dilma Rousseff's cell phone. These programs were never about terrorism. They're about economic spying, social control, and diplomatic manipulation. They're about power. Well, whatever you make of what Snowden says about these things, it does seem to me that the question of democracy in relation to digital dragnets is a good one for us to ask. Judge Pauly, who followed the Judge Leon decision with his own finding, argued that Governments have to use bulk telephony metadata in order to find, I quote, find and isolate gossamer contacts among suspected terrorists in an ocean of seemingly disconnected data. Notice in his phrase, we move beyond the familiar haystacks to oceans. This is big data with a vengeance. And he goes on to say, this blunt tool only works because it collects everything. Italian philosopher Agamben suggests that under the new sign of security under which governments are operating today, management is the order of the day. It spurns the rule of law for security, and in the process also destroys, he argues, the possibility of politics itself. The security state no longer maintains order, rather it just manages disorder. It attacks any dissent within a permanent kind of state of exception. The idea of crisis, says Agamben, has lost its temporality. What you might once think of as crisis, which is a blip, it's a problem, it's something we've got to deal with, and we deal with it somehow, and eventually the waves settle down and crisis is over or averted or whatever. Agamben argues that crisis has become a permanent way of ruling. Moreover, he argues, because we are told that we can no longer govern causes, we can no longer explore the causes of the kinds of issues that confront us, all we can do is govern the effects. Causes, of course, have to be known. Effects just call for control. So it militates against our desire to find out the causes and to address the issues that create disadvantage, discomfort, whatever. And it makes control the motif of everyday life, not just the appropriate pursuit of criminals and genuine suspects. And so he goes on. But I think that the kinds of questions he's asking are ones that we too would do well to ask. If privacy is provoked, then what is it? What is it that is being provoked by these findings of these disclosures of Snowden? Common response is, well, we need to protect more privacy. We need to get a hold on this, and privacy is the key idea for mobilizing public opinion against unnecessary, illegal, or excessive surveillance. But it seems to me that privacy on its own is certainly inadequate, and that other values are also at stake, especially those around accountability and rights, and in relation to freedom and dignity. Let me just refer you to one writer whose work I think is very apposite for this, and her name is Julie Cohen, and the book in which she discusses this material is called Configuring the Networked Self. I think this is a very helpful approach, and what she shows primarily is the ways in which Western liberal legal and political thought is structured around in relation to privacy, is structured around something that is a very abstract and disembodied concept, something that is a move away from the real lives that we live from day to day. And she argues very strongly for a very different approach to what is called privacy, and to go beyond it. Freedom and dignity, I suggest, have to do with how people should be treated just because they have worth. Not with some qualification, but simply because of their humanness. And that connects with broader arguments about the common good and human flourishing. I already made comments about social sorting, so I don't think I need to take you further into that. As I say, the arguments about social sorting have to do with the use of algorithms for classifying and organizing populations into groups with more and more granular precision so that we can be put in different categories to be treated differently. Certain groups, I've argued, are more vulnerable than others, and that vulnerability tends to be exacerbated both in relation to the kinds of government intelligence surveillance that Snowden's, which is Snowden's main focus, but also in regard to commercial surveillance. Again, if you're interested in the field, the work of Oscar Gandy, G-A-N-D-Y, is tremendously important here. And it's he who uses that term, cumulative disadvantage, to show that those who are disadvantaged in the consumer realm are cumulatively so because of the ways in which the stereotypes and the build-up of negative responses to those particular groups is concatenated in their categories. So, in short, I've been trying to say that the so-called snooping scandal is much more than that, and much more than a mere temporary blip from which the status quo will soon be resumed. I think it raises basic questions, and I hope you've seen some of the ways in which I have argued that those basic questions need to be asked. In a digital, data-driven world, we need to know more about what corporations and government agencies are doing, and invites us to interrogate what we really mean when we call for more privacy. The Snowden revelations, I think, show us that many things that I would think of as human flourishing are challenged in a profound way. Snowden has spoken out. Not many others are speaking out, but an interesting and sizable minority is speaking out. He speaks out against expanding, unacknowledged, and sometimes illegal state and corporate surveillance. But I think that the debate that he's opened takes us beyond the usual binaries, security versus liberty and so on, and outside the box of privacy. I've suggested that questions about human dignity, human freedom, freedom of expression, freedom of association, for example, these are bigger questions that we should also be addressing. Who will join the debate on matters like the internet's its original goals of openness and accountability? Who's asking the questions? Not just about reducing harms, but about promoting human flourishing. Perhaps we should ask ourselves how much we'll speak out with Mr. Snowden. Thank you.